I wanted to find out what can I do physically without legs, simply. So this is why I tried all those sports and adventure as much as I could put my hands on. Then after that, I just knew that, anything is possible. It's different, this different way of doing the things. It wasn't the things that like I thought about it. If we see the disabled population, there's 1.3 billion disabled people around the world, and you can't hide them.
Team, welcome back. Another week here with Drew and Alex. And this week, before we kick things off, I just wanted to do kind of a quick poll. Obviously, we can't see anybody, but just show of hands, how many people taste soap when they eat cilantro?
And he asks this question because Drew is one of the unfortunate weirdos who has the genetic
20%. 20%. This is why I was what I was Googling. 20% of the population experiences soapy tasting cilantro.
With no cilantro, what do you even do?
I don't put cilantro on anything. I actually just had.
Of course you don't, because you taste soap.
Just tonight, I had a banh mi sandwich with no cilantro. It's disgusting.
It's like
I feel bad.
Even,
what does it taste like? What does it taste like to you?
Delicious, like cilantro. I don't know what to call it.
Is it spicy? Is it sweet?
It's a similar plant to parsley, so it's not that different from parsley.
Parsley is also not that good.
What?
I have a parsley plant like in my herb garden. I don't really use it.
I feel like you're going through life missing out on all these important flavors.
Well, so it's funny because here, this is Britannica I'm referencing, so it's legitimate. It says that there's some evidence that cilantrophobes, that's me, can overcome their aversion with repeated exposure to the herb, especially if it's crushed rather than served whole. But many people simply choose to go with their genetic inclinations and avoid its soapiness altogether. Speaking of, I also don't like guacamole, probably because of the cilantro.
What? Yeah, that's obviously why. That's the only possible reason.
Avocado
to not like guacamole.
To me, avocado just tastes like mud. It tastes like cold mud.
I feel like
you pull it out of a fridge.
All of your taste buds are wrong. Like you're just not good at tasting things.
I don't like earthy flavored stuff.
Man,
doesn't add.
I'm sorry.
More to follow. I'd be curious though for folks. You should do a poll, one of those Instagram polls.
Okay, I can do a poll.
I like to
see if our population has a representative 20%.
20%. Stupid transition here, but the guest for this week has absolutely nothing to do with cilantro, although we didn't ask him. Maybe he's one of my people.
We can shoot him an email and find out.
We should. Who are we talking to?
We are talking to Hari Buddhamagar, and on a twist from how I do some other bios for guests, I'm just gonna do like an abridged version of his life story from the beginning, because I think it sets the stage pretty well for how incredible this guy is. Hari was born in 1979 in a village in the foothills of the Himalayas in Nepal. He was born in a cow shed at an altitude of 2,500 meters in an extremely remote part of Western Nepal. He grew up in Merol in the Rolpa district of the Himalayas. As a child, he was walking like 45 minutes to an hour each way to school and back barefoot.
Let me just pause you for people that don't know. 2,500 meters is like a mile and a half. So it's very high.
Yeah.
Keep going.
Walking barefoot to school, hour each way, probably in the snow, as we know. It's always uphill both ways. There were no pens or paper at his school. He learned to write with chalk stone on a wooden plank. He was forcibly married at the age of 11. And as a teenager, he was surrounded by the Nepalese Civil War, where more than 17,000 people were killed over a period of 10 years. So on the back of an upbringing like that, Hari joined the British Army via the Royal Gurkha Rifles. Don't worry, we'll explain what the whole concept of the Gurkhas is in the episode. He joined when he was 19. He served across five continents, doing training and operations for the British Army with roles including combat medic, sniper, covert surveillance, and other things, all kind of traditional infantryman roles. And then I guess we will go into the details of the story of his injury in the episode. I won't take that away from him because he'll discuss it. But he did get injured in combat. He did lose both of his legs above the knee. And since his injuries, he has tried a variety of sports and adventures, including golf. Yes, Drew, he golfs. Skiing, skydiving, kayaking, and rock climbing, as well as playing wheelchair rugby and wheelchair basketball. But wheelchair sports was not enough for him. Kind of the primary thing we're going to focus on here. In 2017, he became the first double amputee to summit a mountain taller than 6,000 meters. That was Mara Peak. And then in May of 2023, he became the first ever double above the knee amputee to summit Mount Everest. So not a guy who is easily deterred by setbacks.
Well, not to mention, and again, this we'll kind of flesh this out in the episode, but right before, as he was planning to climb Everest, 2017-ish timeframe, Nepal actually banned solo climbers, blind climbers, and double amputee climbers from climbing Everest. So you would think, kind of as I thought as I learned about his story, I kind of assumed, like, I don't know, the Everest space would get pumped about this kind of thing, but like, no, his country actually made it very, very difficult for him to see this through. And we get into some of that, just this idea of having gone through so much to get to the point at which he was ready to actually execute this climb, he was told he couldn't do it. So, I mean, you kind of gave the abridged version of his life story, which he'll get into in a lot more detail. But even just from that excerpt, it's pretty obvious that we're dealing with a very unique guest this week, and certainly a very unique story.
And it's interesting to hear from him kind of the difference between the way he grew up and how that builds resilience and things like that, and the life his children are living now, living more westernized lifestyles. I think, and I may or may not be correct on this one, but I think as we were talking to him, he was preparing to head out to Mount Rainier for some more mountaineering on the west coast of the U.S. Just a dude who does not stop. He has a ton of really impressive goals that he's continuing to chase. Just fascinating what it takes to overcome the hurdles. Like, hiking and running for him are all about just hip flexors. So it's a completely different activity for him that he's training for at this point, because the musculature is so different. Just absolutely fascinating.
He also has a fantastic mustache.
This is true.
If anybody wants to give him a Google, Wikipedia page, just a devilish smolder and a fantastic mustache. And as we discussed, we'll find out if he ever gets cilantro stuck in that mustache. So without further ado, enjoy. You mentioned that you live in the UK. Obviously, your kids, I think, were born and raised there, correct?
No, they're... One was born in... I got three kids, and one was born in Nepal, one was born in Brunei, one was born in UK.
Jeez. Well, and you had mentioned, I think it was, that your childhood was very different from your kids' childhood. And I'm just curious to, like, turn you loose on that, to hear what it was like for you growing up where you grew up.
I think my children's childhood and my childhood is, I think, about three generations different. You know, the way I grew up. So all of my children, they were born in hospitals. But I was born in a cow shed. There's no hospitals. So my mom gave me a bird when she was herding the cattles. So I was born in a cow shed. And I went to school barefoot. I didn't have any pen and paper, so I learned on wooden plank with a chalky stone. That's how I learned to write. I had to walk about 45 minutes each way. Some of the children actually walk longer than me, about 2 hours in one way, just to go to school. That's how I grew up. And also, I was forced to marry at age of 11. And what else? Yeah, I grew up in civil war. And it lasted for 10 years, and more than 17,000 people were killed. and many more are still missing. Wow. So luckily we have peace there in the government now. So I don't know why we have to fight in the first place, you know.
I think a direction this conversation is going to go is going to be a lot of focus on resilience and overcoming hardship and things like that. We haven't even gotten to some of the more significant hardship you faced, but how do you think growing up in an environment like that prepared you for some of the challenges you ended up facing later in life?
I never knew what was the outside world apart from a village that I was born. So I didn't know outside world, how was, never traveled, never got into the plane until I joined the Gurkhas, and you know, never seen when I was in young, I never seen like cars and cycles. No, never seen that way. So I didn't know that how the outside world was. Just I just wanted to something change. I was hungry, and I think because of that hardship, that you know, I wanted something better life. And so my parents, they all of their life, they work in the farms, like in the West, it's like a farmers are rich in Nepal and many countries around the world. Farming is simply it's a surviving. So we work, you know, for a year, and sometimes food might not be enough to still, you know, to look after ourselves. And my mom and dad, they just whole of their life, they just, you know, worked so hard. They have no pension, and they just, you know, work everything, just better future for, you know, us, for us. So that's what they did. So looking my children now is, you know, in the tablets and, you know, watching a TV to, you know, just they get dropped, you know, door, you know, in the car, at door of the, you know, having it, you know, air condition in the car and heaters, and just, you know, eating, you know, whatever food they want. You know, we didn't have a choice. We used to eat meat maybe once every few months.
Wow.
So yeah, and we didn't only one time we used to change the clothes. So we'll get new clothes. It's like a Christmas time here, but we call it Dasain in Nepal. So you know, that's how I grew up. I grew up in very little, and I'm very. I feel very lucky to living the life that I'm living in. I'm happy to die anytime apart from leaving my family. I think I have achieved enough. But I think whatever we have right now is because of our previous generations that, they worked hard and, you know, they challenged themselves and, they work for our freedom and peace. And I think whatever we do, I think is going to be for our future. So yeah, I'll be keep working as much hard as I possibly can, and hopefully my challenge will be something that future generation can learn from my life and my challenges.
Do you ever, when your kids are acting up with their tablets, do you ever just snap at them and be like, I was writing on a rock, you can relax with your tablet?
I say to them sometimes, but I think that for them it's kind of like I'm telling the story, or it's like a joke.
Well, I want to ask you, because you had mentioned that you recognized pretty early on that kind of your way out of that environment was through education. And I think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were the first one in your village to go to high school or graduate high school?
Yeah, I was the first guy to graduate from high school. Yeah, just pass high school. It's like, I don't know what is the system, school system here in the US, but in the UK, you go to school depends on your age group, right? Mm-hmm. So Even you fail, you don't achieve enough, then still you just keep it going. Maybe you are bottom of the class, but still you keep going. In Nepal, if you don't achieve the pass grade, you stay that class for forever. So actually, I studied 2 years in class 8, and you know, in high school, I did my exam on English. So I have to wait another year to actually give that test. So I failed twice. But I was the first person to pass the high school from my village. So
what do you think, like, why — this sounds like a weird question, but like, why you? Like, how do you think it was that your perspective kind of pushed you on that path where I think maybe some of your peers might not have had the same vision?
I think one thing was I was forced to marry at the age of 11. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I refused, but, you know, where are you going to go? There's no, like, social services in Nepal or, you know, anything. So, as I said, you know, you don't know outside world. You know, what is the world like? So, you know, when I was first married, I was just, thinking that the way to get out this relationship is to, you know, get independent. And to get independent, you know, I had no other choice other than, you know, going to school, get educated, and, you know, run away from home. And that's what I did.
Jeez.
Your process of leaving home, unless I've got it wrong, heavily relied on applying to and then getting accepted to the Gurkha Regiment in the British Army. First off, I think I'm only like vaguely aware of how that process works. How many apply? How hard is it to get in? What even is the Gurkha Regiment? I think most of our audience only knows the American military. So if you could get us up to speed on that, I think that'd help a lot.
Yes, simply the Gurkhas are, you know, men from Nepal working for British Army. Some of them still in Indian Army. Some of them, you know, Singapore Police Force. They are called Gurkhas. So simply, Nepalese men working abroad as a military. So we are working for United Kingdom over 209 years. So we got involved to pretty much all the wars, all the conflicts that the Great Britain got involved. So simply every year, so we had like 10 regiments, and when India got independence from United Kingdom, 6 regiments stayed in India. And 4 regiments went with the, you know, UK. It's called, you know, British Gurkhas or Indian Gurkhas or Singapore Gurkhas or, you know, Brunei Gurkhas. We have like our own regiments in the British Army. This is why we kind of special. We have a different culture, different values, different ethos, but also, following the, you know, British Army doctrine. So,
What does that ascension process look like? I mean, how did you know that those were even a thing? And then, like, what gates did you have to go through to get accepted?
It's about 6 months selection process in 3 stages. So in the first stage, we call it Gallawala, which is a recruiter. And he goes to the village and, you know, select from one person, one recruiter can select only 60 people. So maybe a couple of 100 people, and he selects 60 people. Then they go to the regional selection, and in 60 people, only 6 people, six vacancies. So in regional selections, so only 6 people six people can get a place. How good they are, it doesn't really matter. So there's this limited vacancy. So just six. Then those six people go to the central selection for a month, and they test you pretty much everything from your fitness to your education to your social skills, your leadership skills, your IQ, pretty much everything.
Since you mentioned it, this is not something I really thought about, but you talked about how the Gurkha regiments have different culture and different values unique to them within the British Army. What makes them unique? There's clearly something that the British see as like uniquely valuable to maintain this very unique recruiting process and everything. What makes the Gurkha regiments special and different?
There are many ways we are different. So we came from Nepal, so we are little soldiers, but just we can run up and down over the hill. So I think quite easily. But also the culture is different. So, and also, you know, like a British Army recruit, their basic training is 2 months and our training is 9 months. And we have got like own regiments, we have own values, ethos, the way we respect our seniors is different. And, you know, we still have like, say, our own food and, you know, like, we still celebrate our festivals, the culture, all the cultural things that we celebrate. So I think that's what it's called, bonding. We have a, like, say, Hindu and Buddhist temple in our camp. So, yeah, many, many ways. We have like temple service.
I want to know how you trained for that selection process in your village. So like prior to going, I would assume that you were in some kind of shape to do well. What did that look like for you being so isolated but needing to perform?
I didn't train much. I just, I was going to college, and in the morning I just used to run a little bit. Because I think, the selection process, there is two tests, is physically quite hard. You have to do all the obstacles and other bits as well. But mainly, we have to run 1.6 miles. In at least 9 months to pass it. That's just flat, just run fast. The other one is we have to, at the moment it reduced it because of diversity and so many other ways. But at my time we carried 35 kilograms and run uphill 4 kilometers just on the step only, so. And I think I don't know what is the time but yeah, we ran up the hill. So that you carry the basket at the back with the weight, and we run up the hill.
So just basically just moving around in Nepal gets you really fit is what I'm hearing.
And I never ran in a flat. So actually I came to kind of train a few days ago, but I was actually got injured actually then, because you can't run in flat. So running in trail and running in a flat is completely different. I never realized that, but I thought that is that running in a flat is easy, but running in a flat is hard.
Jeez.
So this is going to be a little bit of foreshadowing to some of the conversation we're going to have in a few minutes, I think. But we did an episode a month or two ago about the British Royal Army Physical Training Corps. And one of the topics we talked about a lot was the whole emphasis on adventurous training, taking British soldiers and doing hiking, mountaineering, kayaking, rock climbing, mountain biking, all these outdoor sports things. Is that something you got while you were serving with the Gurkhas? And it seemed like that became important to your recovery. So can you speak to like embracing that outdoor sport stuff as part of your training?
Yeah, I was fortunate to in the British Army, it's compulsory to do 180 years of adventure training, you call it. So it's compulsory that you take part in some of those events. And now I realize that, you know, those outdoor sports and adventure, and not just kind of outdoor sports and adventure, but that generally sport has so much power that it gives confidence back. So I kind of, you know, realized now that, you know, the British Army pays you and also facilitated that, you know, another training. There is a reason, and it has such a power. And if there wasn't sport and adventure, simply I wouldn't be here. I would be nearly dead. So sport and adventure is, I think, has amazing power to give us our confidence back.
What were you, so you were in the British military, you had gotten through the whole Gurkha, I guess, pipeline. What kind of training, what sort of additional qualifications did you pursue while you were active duty?
We have different departments that where we can go. So from in the Gurkhas, we have got like engineers, signalers, you know, logistics and brigade band and infantry. And simply I was infantry. I wanted to go to logistics, but, you know, I was thrown to in the infantry. So, you know, I think many times in my life is it just happened, whatever that I really don't want to do. So I didn't want to go. Even in infantry, you know, you have got different sectors. You can be the sniper or motorman, or you can go to the, you know, like vehicle departments. You can go to logistics. You can go to, so they're like a small, small engineering department in there, that the signals department works on communication. Yeah, they're like, I say, like anti-tank regiments where you can use the, like javelins, things to destroy the enemy tanks. And we have the Rocky platoon who actually does surveillance for the regiment. So, yeah, there are lots of, departments that you can go. For me, I came to this rifle company as infantry in man. Then I was trained the sniper. I was trained team medic. I was in Pioneer, which is the, engineering department for the regiment. I worked 6 years there, and I went back again to a rifle company, and I was injured as a in multiple twice. I was injured.
What was your favorite part?
The most I hated doing that job, one hard one. I think it's that I'm more proud now. At that time, I didn't like it, but you know, it's hard. Like being a sniper is not easy. Or even being in engineers is hard, but the hardest job is the more I think I feel proud now.
Yeah, that's fair.
Well, you mentioned during that you got injured, and I think obviously that's a core part of your story and how we came to be talking to you about it. But just for the audience's sake, who aren't familiar with your story at all, can you just walk us through what happened the day of your injury? What was happening? What was your experience? How did you survive?
I was deployed in Afghanistan in Helmand province in 2010. And we were just got in there just a couple of weeks. On that day, our job was to go and give security to two engineers so they can go and survey the well. So later they can go and repair that old well so local people can have water. And another one was to familiarize with the new area. So that was our mission. We're 20 in the squad, and I was 10th in the single file. So we crossed a couple of irrigation ditches, compounds, and we're just walking on the side of the poppy field. And suddenly went bang, and yeah, my life pretty much changed in the blink of eye. I was the only one that was got injured. On that day, I wasn't with my team. I was with another team at test. So normally I'm a second man, you know, from the back, because my job is second in command and for the multiple, and my job is to look after the logistics, the administrations, and all the bits, where the, you know, the commanders lead from the front. So that was my job. But on that day, I was just being just normal soldier's job in the middle. So the many other commanders who was also doing exactly the same. Yeah, and I think I was at you know, same part. It was very narrow part, and you know, I was just wrong place at wrong time. And why the nine guys didn't, you know, there wasn't blood up, and why it was me. But I think that even I wasn't there, someone would be on that, you know, 10th guy, and somebody would have, you know, blown up. So that's fine. I got blown up, but I survived. So I'm grateful for that. The IED went off. That was, I think, pressure plate. I stepped on it. Everybody stepped in it, but when I stepped in it, it's, you know, went off. And the first thing I noticed was it was ringing my right ear. I had a radio on the left, and yeah, it was just ringing my right ear, and this cloud everywhere. And, you know, the guys are shouting out, you know, man down, you know, take cover. It's normal military drill we do. I looked down my right leg, it wasn't there anymore. I had left leg, but it was dangling and bone and skin. So I also injured my right arm, so couldn't able to move. And, you know, my colleagues came and, you know, sort the bomb around me, just clear up and pass me up, give me first aid, call the heli, and yeah, rescued on time. So we survived.
I remember hearing that you got picked up relatively quickly, right? Within, I mean, 15 or so minutes. Did that, I mean, I guess reflecting back on that whole process, I can imagine that of all things would be something that you're pretty grateful for.
Yes. I was rescued in 17 minutes. So I was rescued by your guys called Pedro. I think they were going to another mission, and I was much more serious. So it was diverted and they picked me up. This is why it was so fast. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the guys did amazing job, and I remember everything until, you know, the guy in heli gave me a mask and start cutting my combat dress, and as I passed away, woke up next day in Kambasam in a field hospital.
So what was the process like? I mean, first it's a question of, are you going to survive? Then it's a question of, are you going to keep part of that left leg, or what's going to happen? What was that process like of coming to terms with what your injury looked like and what the road ahead for rehab was going to be?
You know, I thought, you know, before we went to Afghanistan, I thought that I might die. I thought that, you know, I might get shot. I might lose my limb, but I never thought that I would lose both limbs. You know, I never thought that. And the first thing was, you know, am I going to survive? Am I going to see my family? That was the first thing. And the About 5 minutes later, the guy said that heli inbound in 10 minutes. That's, oh, I think I'm going to survive, you know. So then after that, I thought about my colleagues because I was in second in command in the team, and I was most senior Gorkha, you know, in the squad. So, you know, I was kind of there like a big brother or like a father figure in the team. So they listen. We have very young platoon commander who just commissioned, and we trained six months together and went to Afghanistan. So, you know, the boys in my team just looked at me, and I really felt that I let down. And I failed them, and what's going to happen to them? I thought that, you know, they will be like, you know, chicks without their mom. You know, that's what I was thinking. And I really, really worried about. I went back to UK, and about 2 months still I was worrying, and my military liaison officer said, don't worry about yourself, worry about you. You know, that's what he said, but, you know. You know, in the battlefield, you know, leaving your colleague, comrades in the battlefield is just, you know, not the right thing. You know, but you know, I couldn't fight, so you know, I had to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you kind of touched on it there, but I'm curious to dive a little bit deeper. What for you was kind of the mental health journey from, I guess, the point of injury, which you talked about, and then just coming back through the rehab, reconciling with the fact that, like, this was basically, I mean, you had to get pulled out of the battlefield. Like you mentioned, you had to leave the guys behind. So what did that look like for you from a mental health standpoint?
Yeah, I always have some kind of guilt. You know, I kind of failed them, you know, you know, the aim was to go to Afghanistan, stay 6 months, do our job and try to keep safe everyone and, you know, go back to home. That was the plan. And then it didn't happen. Later, there was another incident and we lost one guy and there's two other got injured. So four of us were down in 14 in the squad. So, yeah, couldn't able to do that. And my mental, initially, you know, I thought that I couldn't do anything, you know. I had to sit on a wheelchair for the rest of my life. I was very unaware and uneducated about disability, that what could be done, what can I do, because the way I grew up in Nepal, I thought that, you know, I couldn't do anything, so, you know, I had to be a burden of the earth, and maybe I've done something in my previous life, so maybe, you know, I'm having this. So this is the kind of things that I thought and lay, and kind of one point I was just drinking so much to just control my pain and emotion, and yeah, it wasn't nice feeling, you know. You know, my brain's got foggy, and you know, I couldn't focus on some things. You know, my memory went pretty, my short memory went pretty bad. And when I was just coming out of the military, you know, I always thought that, you know, I grew up in pretty much toughest place possibly in the world, you know, getting, you know, beaten by, you know, parents who went barefoot to school, and those are the things, you know, so, and also, you know, I'm the Gurkha, and I'm military man, and, you know, I'm the most strongest man, you know, in maybe in the world. So that's what I kind of, nothing's gonna, you know, defeat me. That's what I kind of, my mental was. But later, you know, I was getting those symptoms. We came to Texas in one of the, you know, charity event. And one of my, I came with one of my firefighter friends. And yeah, we, you know, we just it was very little things that, and I nearly fought with him. And later when I calmed down, he said, I think, Harry, you need help. And I said, well, what the fuck that help is? And I say, okay, I think you need to go to some treatment. I don't need it, I told him. And somehow he was kind of pursued me, and he contacted the combat stress in the UK. So that's simply the mental health charity. And somehow he persuaded me. He called them, and they called me, and yeah, I went 6 weeks, 6 weeks treatment. And I was diagnosed with the PTSD, and yeah, I kind of realized that. Later I realized, yeah, you know, we all have weaknesses, so you know, just accept it sometimes. You know, I think the best thing for me was I didn't recognize myself who I was. You know, I was trying to be someone else. You know, you see some room, you know, the people, and you want to be like that, right? And I was like that. And I think after my injury, the best thing was, I think I was able to recognize myself who I am. And I think when God or nature created us, it created us individual person. We are three brothers, and we completely different characters. So, after my injury, accepting that I don't have legs, accepting that, you know, I have some mental issues that I need to address and get treatment, and also just me as a Hari Buddha Magar, I used to lie that, oh, I was from much better family background. Those are the things. But because I'm here because of my past, I try to be as a Hari Buddha Magar and lived it. And this is confidence, really happier. When we're trying to be someone else, that's the time that, you know, we doubt ourselves. We don't feel good. I think we living in someone's values than our values. So I think, living our values, that's, I think we feel happy. Just gain the confidence. And I think confidence is pretty much everything in life. And those confidence I gain from sports and adventure mainly.
I want to ask you, because one of the things that we've talked about on here a couple of different times with a couple of different people is kind of the stigma around mental health and the stigma around, you mentioned PTSD and just sort of moral injury. And I hadn't really even thought about this until you started talking, but you're coming into this from an entirely different background, culturally, spiritually. I mean, you mentioned sort of the preconceptions around disability when we think of rural Nepal. And I can only assume that the British military's system for supporting wounded soldiers who are dealing with mental health issues is kind of catered towards that culture and that environment. And this is kind of a roundabout question, but what I'm curious about is, for you and the background you came from and kind of the preconceptions you had about all these things that you teased out with your injury, did you find that that was a supportive environment? And did you find that for you as an individual, you were able to kind of get the treatment that you needed for what you were dealing with?
There are lots of misconceptions, pretty much, I think, in military, about mental health. In British Army, there is this still. Also about disability, the way I perceived myself, it was hard. But I think one thing is, once you accept yourself, then it becomes easy to deal the things up. So okay, I don't have legs, you know, they're never gonna grow. So yeah, I have to accept whatever that is and just do whatever I can, you know. And also, you know, if you are weak, seen as weak in military, you know, I just don't want to say, I can't say that, but
we know.
But I just don't want to say, but okay, like, yeah, you adapt, you know, or like say, we've been told like that, so, and we tell the other people that way. So, you can't show your weakness, right, in military. So that's what's kind of military mindset. Also, there is not enough. It's much better than it used to be about mental health and diagnosing mental health, getting help in mental health. But the like even the combat stress, which is kind of funded by from the non-profit charities like public, and also from the National Health Service, but they can just treat so many people. They don't have capacity to treat like a huge number at once, and everybody want to get treated. And I think many people that is most people that we have a same mindset that would like to call it military mindset, that you can't show our weaknesses. And still, there are many people that who will not show it. It defined, like, I think it's difficult. Some ways. I was, linked to combat stress and had a treatment, and I feel lucky that I still struggle sometimes. But I know how to manage it, and they taught me so much things, like say, your psychology, how the psychology works, to like say being mindfulness. Like yoga, meditation, arts, the things that how to switch, cut off that negative feelings, how to manage your anger. They equip us with so many things. And yeah, I do that. So if I'm feeling something negative, and just do some exercise, go for walk, or go for gym, or go for swim. Whatever that is. And I think both negative and positive, mind is equally powerful. And if we step on negative, we see whole world is negative. If we see positive, you see everything is positive. So I think that's what I think.
We've talked about the mental health journey in general and some of the things that helped you, but I want to dive in specifically to two topics that we see a lot in our military. I know there are issues in other militaries, but specifically, I know you turned for at least a period to alcohol use to deal with some of the things you were struggling with. And then I think at around the same time, you were also struggling with suicidal thoughts. Can you speak to some of those experiences and what you found that got you out of that and into the place you are now, where you're talking about the positivity and the exercise and the yoga and the mindset?
So just coming out of those thoughts was, one point. So I had so when I was injured, my son was 2.5 years old. He was just little toddler and just really bubbly, and like just so cute, and just I always wanted to be around him. And after my injury, I tried to take my life here as well, a few times. Just feeling negative feelings, or even when you see at home, you look at the ceiling, and in Nepal, most of the ceilings are like a fan, right? Many people, strangle themselves on it. And I kind of, still, thinking about how to do that. Also, train bridges in UK, mostly they are protected. They have got a wall on the side. So those are, I couldn't drive at the time, so maybe just drive on my own, and just maybe just, you just can't feel all those negative things. And one day I just was drunk quite a lot. And next day I woke up and I didn't feel very good, right? And I realized that, if I was drinking that way, then I would die soon, and that was going to happen. And yeah, if I die, it's in my story, but my family will suffer from that. And I really didn't want it that even I'm on my wheelchair for the rest of my life, I still can advise my children what to do, maybe what not to do. So one day I kind of decided that, okay, I'm going to live my life for my, you know, family. And that was completely, you know, then it was completely different. Okay, then I want to do something. I didn't know what to do. And that is the time that my completely switched different. Oh, now I want to do that. I want to do that. So the first thing I did was skydiving. And because I was half suicidal mode, so if I fall down and die, that's fine. And half my body's gone, so if another half goes, that's fine. You know, I didn't realize that how powerful is the mind.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. So, and another one was I just wanted to experience the skydiving, which is I never done that before. So yeah, went up, and when I landed, we landed safely on the ground. And like, you can do the things even if you don't have legs. And after that, I wanted to find out what can I do physically without legs, simply. So this is why I tried all those sports and adventure as much as I could put my hands on. Then after that, I just knew that, you know, anything is possible. It's different, this different way of doing the things. It wasn't the things that, like, I thought about it. If you see the disabled population, there's 1.3 billion, you know, disabled people around the world. And you can't hide them, you know. I was okay until, you know, I had a four limbs up to the age of 31 and suddenly lose it. And if we just be at the wrong time, at the wrong place, then yeah, we may die, we may be disabled, whatever that is. And it just simply do whatever we love to do. I think if we're scared, we can't do anything. You know, just walking down the street, it's dangerous. You know, driving a car is dangerous. You know, everything is, if you think it, you may be walking down the stairs and, you know, fall down, trip over, hit your head somewhere else, and you might get on the wheelchair for the rest of life, or you might just be dead. So no point getting scared. I think many people tell me that, yeah, you are a bit mad and crazy. Yeah, maybe a little bit, but I try not to be stupid. As long as you don't be stupid, we are sensible and take the risk accordingly, and I think, yeah, we'll be fine. And when we try, we achieve, I think, many things.
So at what point in that journey, like as you were building momentum and kind of trying new things and checking new boxes and realizing all the things you can do versus the things that you can't do, at what point did you turn your eyes to Everest?
The Everest was always in my, excuse me. So Everest was always in my head from your young child, because in Nepal, everywhere, you know, very little child, we are educated that, you know, Mount Everest is tallest peak in the world and it's in Nepal. And that simply for we Nepalese people are very proud of that, you know, Mount Everest is in Nepal. It's our pride, it's our identity. So we're you know, many people here in the US, if you ask them, do you know Nepal? And especially don't know. And if you say, do you know the Everest? That most people knows. And yeah, it's the bottom of that. So I was always fascinated by that. And even when I was in the army, I wanted to do it, climb, but, you know, I needed lots of money and I needed at least 2 months just to climb, but also lots of training. So, you know, my boss, they wouldn't allow me to do that. So, you know, after losing my legs, when I was skiing in Colorado, in Whistler in Canada, and in Alps in Europe, and just thinking, or always looking at the snow-capped mountain, just thinking about Everest, and how am I going to do it without legs? You know, that was in my mind. So later I went in Nepal to just find out how my body feels in altitude, and also whether it's physically possible. And I went in 2016, tested myself, and yeah, some ways I believed that, you know, it would be possible. You know, in my logic was like, they were like this. So in old days, we couldn't run fast enough to explore around the world. So we designed the things that can take us faster in the land, sea, and air. Now we can go to another planet. Who made that possible? It's a human made possible. So guy with the no legs climbing the Everest would be possible. That's always in my mind. So that was always in my mind and tested. And once I said I'm going to climb, then initially nobody believed me. You know, I had some compensation money when I lost my legs, and I used that to climb a few mountains. After that, you know, my family, friends start kind of supporting me. Some charities start supporting me. And after I committed my friends and, you know, other people, then I had to at least give a go.
You mentioned in there about training, and given that this podcast focuses heavily on how people train for the military and for different challenges and things like that, I'd love to hear what training looks like specifically for climbing Mount Everest for a guy who does not have legs. Like, what changed about your training? What did it look like? What were the activities you did? How did you plan that all out?
So I think maybe just before, I think before the training, I think I should maybe talk about kits and equipments, because I think, you know, most of the kits, it simply, you know, it doesn't work for me. So let's say I can't go buy a summit suit and go and climb, right? So I have to design. So there were even no legs were designed to climb by double hypopnea amputees for the snow and ice. And actually we had to design it. And I'm here in Orlando, and in Orlando, there's DIY legs, and I went and climbed it. So at the moment we are designing. So hopefully, you know, in the future, the amputees, double hypopnea amputees, won't have to struggle like me. And also because I don't have a knee, that means I walk from my hip. So like in the deep snow, simply I'm stuck there. If I can hold somewhere, then I can pull myself out. But if I can't hold anything, simply I'm stuck there. Also because of my gait is so small, so just walking A to B, simply it takes three times longer than normal people, because my gait is so small and I will have to walk like a penguin. Those are the challenges, and we have to adapt pretty much. And so people say that it's climbing, but for me it's like crawling all the way up and down, simply. So that was, and taking three times longer means I burn three times more energy, and how we gonna mitigate that, you know? So we have to set up maybe different camps, and maybe for short routes and so many other ways. So I have to train that way. So, and also, you know, I can't run because I didn't have a knees, so I can't run. So the only way to pump my lungs up is to do hand cycling, or like, you know, doing hand drawing, or, you know, skiing, or some ways to pump my lungs, or swimming. That's the only way I pump my lungs. So if let's say training coming, then simply I go 5 days a week, a 2 hour session. So I go half an hour just for make sure my I go and walk on the treadmill. I can't run, so I walk just to keep activating the my muscles, my glutes, my cores. And then I go for like cardiovascular, 15, 20 minutes. That's more about like just pumping the lungs up. Then I go to strength and conditioning. So it depends on, so like if I'm doing lots of technical climb, I train that way. If I, let's say, do let's do lots of walking, then I train that way. And then I go for swim for half an hour. And come back for, go for like a sauna. So normally I use a steam one. So just, and then straight go to the cold shower just to adapt the body quickly as possible. So that's kind of, and that's about 2 hours session in the gym. It's quite difficult for me to just to go and walk around on my own, you know, just so it's so it's quite difficult. And in the UK, there's not much place for, like, say, you know, climbing in hills, not many hills here. So I normally train in the gym. But like say training for like mountains, I have to go to mountains, like say training on how to rescue, how to walk, how to put a harness on, how to wear the clothes, what are like kit and equipments do you need, and just test them as well. So I have got some new legs now, and I'll be testing in tomorrow. So tomorrow I'm flying to Seattle to test some of my kit and equipment as well. So.
Well, and I mean, not to mention that I think right before you were about to go or somewhere around that time, didn't Nepal make it so that double amputees and people that were hard of sight weren't able to climb Everest? Is that true?
Yeah. So I supposed to climb in 2018. So, you know, I tested in 2016 and I thought that I will train in 2017. And actually, I was on a mountain for winter training. And at that time, Nepal government brought the new rule that banning double amputees and visually impaired and solo climbers. So initially, we tried diplomatic means. So we went to the politicians, met the ministers, and said, okay, bring the proposal. But I knew that in it has to go to a few different ministries, and it has to go to the parliament, and they have to vote it to, you know, overturn that. And it was pretty much none of their interest, and I thought that that's never going to happen in my lifetime. So I went to with National Federation of Disabled Association. I went to Geneva in the United Nations to raise this point. Problem with the United Nations is can't, whatever decision they make is not law binding, so they can't force countries to apply the rules. So we had no other choice than going to Supreme Court in Nepal, and yeah, we're overturned in 4 months, which is, I think, amazing. I think we had lots of help from disabled organizations and individual people, ambassadors, you know, lots of the international medias that would just kind of put lots of pressure onto the government. So, yeah, collectively we were able to overturn. And by the time 2018, it was too late. We couldn't raise money in 2019, 2020, 2021, Corona popped in. So I wanted to do 2022, but my team said, well, we need to raise lots of money. And and also you need to train for 2022. So, okay, that's fine. And then we went and did it in 2023.
So that this begs the question, and one that I wanted to ask you when we realized we were going to bring you on. In your opinion, what was harder, convincing people that you could climb Mount Everest or actually climbing Mount Everest?
I think climbing Mount Everest was just easy. It was like stepping one step at a time. Yeah, it was very dangerous, especially in that zone. If we run out of oxygen, we're just going to die. But I think the other things was hard. So I think if you ask me what is the hardest thing, the hardest thing was to convince other people that I could able to climb and get support. So, initially I asked many corporate companies to sponsor me, and they say it's an amazing story or inspirations. And when it comes to the, taking the money out of from their pockets, they just made an excuse, we ran out of marketing budget or, so much excuse. But there was reason behind it. The first thing was, they didn't believe that I could able to climb it. A second thing was, if something goes wrong on Everest, on a mountain, they didn't want to associate with me. So that was the main reason. But one thing I kind of realized was, if there are, let's say, 100 people or organization, maybe 99 don't believe you, but there's always the one person that or organization that who believes you and supports you. So as long as we have got like right intentions and we are responsible, there is always someone that, help us. When raising the fund, my logic was this. So I needed to raise just over £300,000. And I thought that if I could reach out to 300,000 people and they give me £1 each, and problem solved. That's how I thought. But problem is, the bigger people, they don't want to be seen giving small money, and for other people, they just they don't really care whatever other drinks. That's how I think the human humans are. But finally, I think about 1,200 people donated but also many corporates came in. So once one joins in, another follows, whatever it is, you need inspiration, right? So once one follows it, one does it, and another follows. Let's say Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay didn't climb Mount Everest first, then I think I wouldn't even dare to dream to climbing Mount Everest without legs, right? So I think, even like when you're donating it, if you see the people are donating, you're going to donate, right? So I think that's how it is.
All right, last question for you before we let you go. I want to know, two-part question. What are your upcoming kind of alpine-specific mountaineering goals? And then from a non-mountaineering perspective, what are some things that you want to knock off?
At the moment, I'm preparing to complete my 7 summits, which is highest mountain in its continent. And that would be, I think, something nice to achieve. It would be, and hopefully that would be another world record.
That'd be something nice to achieve. Yeah, for sure. That'd be nice.
Yeah, I think. I think my aim behind that is to making awareness of disability around the world. Because why making awareness of disability is important? Because people like myself, we need to believe that we can able to do something. Which is, I didn't believe when I got injured and I wasted 1.5-2 years of my time. So we need to believe ourselves that we can do something. So that's the one thing, to make awareness to people with disabilities. Another thing is, it's not just our problem, it's a problem of our families and our community and the governments, that who they don't ban you, right? They support you well, so you live as like a normal life. Maybe some of us, our legs might be our weaknesses, our hands might be weaknesses, our eyes, ear, whatever that might be weaknesses. We all have weaknesses. I think no one is perfect in the world. But that doesn't mean that we can't able to do anything. So making awareness of disability. So I have, you know, promised myself that I will be making, because this is not overnight fixed, right? So this is gonna take a long time and possibly beyond I'm gone. So I have promised myself that I'll be making awareness of disability until I die. When I have AIDS, maybe through the sports and adventure, and later maybe the social work, from nonprofits to you know, business and some other ways that I would make awareness of disability, that, you know, disabled people can live a normal life as other people, and we can be happy, successful, and live a meaningful life. You know, that's the one thing. The another thing I really want to do is I want to promote two things. One thing is climate change, because I've been to the mountains and the ice melting so fast. So it's very scary, you know. And I think whatever we're having right now is because of our previous generation. So it's our responsibility to extend the, you know, Earth's life longer, so that our future generations can, I think, enjoy. Mm-hmm. The another thing I would like to do is I want to take the two sides and travel from North Pole to South Pole. And promote peace, because you know, if you see, you know, there's already many examples we have, like say Japan and United States, right? You know, fought each other and now we're allies. Look at Germany and rest of Europe. Even you look at Nepal and Maoist and the other side. Now they are in a government together, coalition government together. So why we have to fight in the first place? You know, I'm the military man, and if you hurt my families, my children, I will still, you know, fight until my last breath. But I think we all have different values, different interests. We have different faith. You know, we grew up in different culture. We perceive the things differently. But in the sake of humanity, we all are humans. And I think, you know, just killing women and children and elderlies, I don't think so. We should do that. I think we don't need to, I think, fight. You know, we can solve our differences in peaceful way. We don't need to solve our differences in, you know, violent way, honestly. And that is what I want to do. And just, I can just try myself and with the help of others, and hopefully that people will see, maybe will send the world leaders that they maybe think twice before they commit for a war. And you know, we don't create a chaos and for sake of humanity, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the work you're doing is incredible. Your story is incredible. Before we let you go, if people are listening to this and like Drew and I among these people, if we want to continue to support your journey and follow you as you take on these challenges, where can people find you? How can people support you?
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for asking me that. Yeah, they can follow me, Hari Budhamagar, on my social. So all of my social is Hari Budhamagar. I've got a website as well, haribudhamagar.com. But just maybe they can go and search in Google that guy with no legs climbed Everest, and maybe they can find it. <way.
laughs> He's not hard to find, guys.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Man, well, again, I know you're literally flying out to Seattle tomorrow. So thank you for taking the time to talk to us. This has been amazing. And we'll put all that in the show notes for people. We'll make it easy to find you. And man, thanks again.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, guys. And you guys have a good day.
You too, man. Well, guys, thanks for listening to another episode with us. I guess before we let you go, the thing that we like to do now, our closing thoughts. Man, I don't know how you put a bow on a guy who climbed Everest with no legs. One of the things that was really interesting to me that I hadn't even really considered until we literally started talking to him was the question that I asked him about mental health and sort of the stigma around mental health and disability, because it's one thing to, I guess, peel back that onion for somebody from like a Western culture, but man, you layer in the spirituality, the religious beliefs around reincarnation. And he mentioned like, what did I do in this past life, in a past life that led this to happen to me in this life? And like, I don't know how you even go at that as a mental health professional in this environment, trying to deal with somebody who's coming at it with all of those layers. That to me is like fascinating and could probably be its own episode.
Well, on that note, something stood out to me. The alcohol stuff and the suicide stuff, I mean, ties into a lot of what we've talked about with mental health in the past, but he specifically mentioned feeling like a burden on his family or on the people around him and things like that. And then the process of rediscovering a sense of purpose. And eventually we'll have to do an episode specifically dedicated to the interpersonal theory of suicide. I think I've mentioned it on the podcast before, I'm not totally sure, but it's the combination of perceived burdensomeness, thwarted belongingness, and then lethal means as a final combination. And I think that template seems to map pretty well onto Hari's experience. And so I think that's something we'll probably dive into on future episodes. But I also thought it was a little interesting how his brush with death seems to have freed him from fear in a certain way. He was willing to do things he had never done before because he figured, man, I've already like nearly died and lost my legs and stuff. Like, what's the worst that can happen? I'll just go the rest of the life.
Jump out of a plane.
And so that was a very interesting thing to hear him talking about, like not being as afraid of the danger of certain activities after that experience.
Something about mountains too, man. Everybody that seems to go through these journeys and ends up climbing a mountain, they just like become hardcore mountaineers, and that just defines them for the rest of their life. So clearly we got to get outside more. But
I was outside earlier. I don't know about you.
Did you climb Mount Everest?
No, I climbed like a hill.
Yeah, I mean, I was outside gardening, but it's, you know, different strokes. But yeah, we have guests on from time to time that are definitely trying to raise awareness. And Hari is one of those guests. So we mentioned it at the end, how you guys can find him. I'm just going to double tap that and say that if you haven't yet, please go visit the show notes, check out his stuff. I think for him, at least, this is kind of just the beginning. He has a lot more to do. He mentioned that one of his goals is to basically fight for world peace. So definitely give him a follow. You know, as more adventures come up, you know, throw some donations at him. We would love to support him in any way that we can. So yeah, see you next week.
Hey, Alex, let's cover our ass real quick.
Oh, great idea, Drew. All right, guys. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode. Before you go, please rate and review the pod on the listening platform of your choice. You can also visit us on our website at www.mopsinmos.com. That's mops, the letter N, mos.com. You can check out the library of podcast episodes, our latest blog entries, any helpful resources, and also sign up for our newsletter.
Drew nailed it. Just to underline a couple of things, the podcast entries have in-depth show notes on the website. So if you missed anything or you want to read any of the research we talk about, it is all there. You can, at the bottom of the website, sign up with your email and receive future updates from us. The blog posts go a little bit more in depth in kind of written form on a couple of topics we get questions about all the time. But most importantly, I just want to ask all you guys, our best way the word gets out is absolutely word of mouth. So tell your friends, tell the people you work with, anybody you think would find it useful. Thanks for spreading the word.
If you have any questions or comments, feel free to shoot us an email at either Drew or Alex at mopsandmos.com.
Or there's a contact form on the website.